I was dating this guy back in high school, and for after prom, we were going to go out to Gilgo because one of his friends had a house out there, but we ended up having to cancel because they found all those dead bodies around the same time as prom.
I live in Suffolk County, and I had no idea that 4 dead women were found on the side of Ocean Parkway. I didn't see it on the news, I didn't see it in the newspaper, not on social media. I don't understand how I did not know about this incident.
I'm Hannah Green.
And I'm Quinn Wolf. And this
is Crime Coast. On December 11th, 2010, the Suffolk County Police Department, with the help of trained cadaver dog Blue, unearthed a body wrapped in burlap buried on the side of Ocean Parkway, 4 miles west of the Oak Beach gated community where Shannon Gilbert was last seen.
2 days later, on December 13th, 2010, 3 more bodies were found.
Each was a whole skeleton, completely intact, wrapped in burlap.
The bodies were deliberately placed 1/10 of a mile away from each other on Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach.
The police were convinced that at least one of these bodies had to be Shannon Gilbert. They immediately went to Joe Brewer's house, searched it, and seized his car.
At this point, it had been 7 months since Shannon had gone missing. Police weren't even actively searching for her at this time. It was a cadaver dog in training that found her.
So now, finally, 7 months later, the local news stations began picking up Shannon's story, mostly because it led to the discovery of 4 bodies.
But, plot twist, none of the bodies were Shannon, which was evident pretty immediately because none of the 4 bodies had a titanium plate in their jaw.
Both Brewer and Shannon's driver, Michael Pack, allegedly took polygraphs. Reports indicate that Pack passed while Brewer's results were unclear.
On January 24th, 2011, the victims were identified as Maureen Brainerd Barnes, 25, of Norwich, Connecticut.
Melissa Bartholomew, 24, of the Bronx.
Megan Waterman, 22, of Scarborough, Maine.
And Amberlyn Costello, 27, of North Babylon on Long Island.
Authorities were quick to state that, much like Shannon, these women worked as escorts and advertised their services on Craigslist.
Oak Beach resident Gus Coletti was quick to point out that it was unlikely that an Oak Beach resident was the perpetrator because, quote, what idiot would bury 4 bodies so close to his own home?
In a press conference on December 16, 2010, the commissioner of the Suffolk County Police Department, Richard Dormer, claimed that he didn't think it was a coincidence that 4 bodies ended up in that area.
However, in the same breath, he stated that, quote, he didn't want people to think they had a Jack the Ripper running around Suffolk County with blood dripping from a knife. This was an anomaly, don't worry. Maureen Brainerd Barnes was last seen alive in New York City on July 9, 2007. Police believed her body was dumped at Gilgo around the same time. So to make it clear, Maureen's body was on the side of Ocean Parkway for over 3 years at the time it was discovered.
She was born on June 14, 1982 in New London, Connecticut, to Marie Ducharme and Bob Senecal. And quick astrology minute, this means she was a Gemini, and Geminis are usually outgoing, intelligent, and a little impulsive.
A fun fact before everything gets super dark is that according to IMBD, she was only 4'11".
If you've ever seen a picture of Maureen, you would know that she was legitimately stunning. She had bright blue-green eyes and dark shoulder-length brown hair. And if you haven't seen any pictures of Maureen, we'll be posting some over on our Instagram at Crime Coast Pod.
Like most of the victims, there isn't a whole lot of info about her around. We did find a lot of info on Reddit and Kolker's book, of course.
So, to bring it back a bit, Maureen grew up in a 3-bedroom apartment in a federally subsidized housing development called, excuse this, Pequannock Village in Groton, Connecticut. From my minimal knowledge of Connecticut and a quick Google search, I've gathered that Groton is a coastal town in Connecticut that borders on the Long Island Sound.
From what we understand, her dad Bob wasn't really in the picture and may have had some substance abuse problems. On an equally awful side note, on Maureen's 21st birthday, Bob actually tripped on a train trestle and drowned in shallow water.
Not to make light of something so dark, but that 100% sounds like something that would happen to me.
Honestly, you're not wrong.
Putting my lack of coordination to the side here, Maureen's mom Marie worked super hard. At one point, she even walked 2 miles every day to clean motel rooms and was usually working about 2 jobs at once.
Maureen was the eldest. She had a younger sister, Melissa, who goes by Missy, and a brother, Will. Since their mom worked so much, they all had a very tight bond, particularly Maureen and Missy.
Missy actually made a Facebook group in honor of Maureen, which we encourage you all to go like and support. It's called In Memory of Maureen Brainerd Barnes, and it gave us a lot of insight into how much Maureen meant to those around her.
According to the Facebook page, Maureen was fiercely independent and highly creative and ambitious.
See, I told you she was a total Gemini.
Right. Apparently, Maureen had big dreams of either becoming a rapper or a model.
She also loved writing poetry, reading, dancing, singing, and most of all, spending time with her children and her family.
Later in life, which feels weird to say since Maureen was only 25 when she died, Maureen went on to marry a man named Jason Brainerd Barnes, and together they had a daughter. However, the marriage was short-lived and they divorced.
Their daughter allegedly lived with Jason in a different part of Connecticut because it was a better school district.
After the divorce, in order to make ends meet, Maureen had pictures taken and she posted them on a modeling website, where the response was overwhelmingly positive. Adult websites and escort services began to reach out.
Maureen then quickly realized that she could make more money as an escort than at her previous jobs delivering pizza or working at ShopRite. She began posting locally on Craigslist.
This is where our information on Maureen gets kind of vague, so bear with us.
Please and thank you.
At some point, Maureen met a man named Steve, and they began dating. Maureen and Steve went on to have a son together, and after he was born, she stopped escorting for a while. However, their relationship would eventually end, and from our research, it seems like it was not a totally amicable split.
So at some point, we think after the split with Steve, she got a job at a place called Atlantic Security as a telemarketer, and she, quote, cleaned up her act, so to speak.
At this job, she met a woman named Sarah. We're going to leave her last name out of the podcast just for legal and privacy reasons, but Sarah and Maureen became rather close.
Maureen even let Sarah come and live with her rent-free after a bad breakup.
I do that for you, for 2 weeks or until your snoring drove me up a wall.
I hate you.
Moving right along.
So now, unfortunately, Sarah and Maureen both lost their jobs at Atlantic Security around the same time.
However, Maureen told Sarah that she was a masseuse, and Sarah became her driver, bringing her from massage appointment to massage appointment. And Maureen would pay her for driving her, and Sarah was curious, but she never questioned Maureen.
Like we stated earlier, Maureen was super close with her family. While she was usually strapped for cash, she loved treating those close to her, and she loved throwing parties and get-togethers to surround herself with those close to her.
Yeah, and it was one of these parties that Maureen eventually told Sarah the truth about her massage appointments.
She even invited Sarah to join her, and Sarah began escorting along with Maureen.
In 2007, Maureen and Sarah went to New York. Maureen was desperate to earn money to prevent her eviction.
On the Sunday of her final weekend, Maureen was short on money, so she decided to stay in the city by herself while Sarah went back to Connecticut.
Her plan was to make the remainder of the $1,100 she needed and wire it to Connecticut to stop her eviction proceedings. On July 9th, 2007, Maureen told Sarah she would keep the motel room and go to see an apartment the two were thinking of renting in the city.
Of course, like any good friend, Sarah was reluctant to leave Maureen, but she and the two friends who worked as their bodyguards left and returned to Connecticut. She promised she'd go back to the city on Wednesday.
In an interview with 48 Hours, her sister Melissa stated that Maureen turned to escorting out of desperation.
She was in the process of getting evicted from her house, and she really needed money, and this was her last resort.
This is important because when Maureen goes missing on July 9th, 2007, she has an impending court date about her said eviction.
Which she absolutely would not have missed.
Right, and now this is where the timeline gets a little fuzzy. When Sarah was on the train back to Connecticut, she received a phone call from Maureen, but she didn't pick up.
Right, so then Maureen called their mutual friend Tony saying that she was robbed by a man with dreadlocks that she and Sarah had met the night before.
Tony then called Sarah and told her to call Maureen back ASAP.
Maureen also called her sister Missy and her brother Will, saying she was at Penn Station, which, if you don't know, it's NYC's hub for most trains, and she said she was going to need them to pick her up once she got back.
What's weird is even though she called Missy and Will after she called Tony, she didn't mention anything about the robbery.
Right, super weird. But anyway, Will and Missy were busy and weren't able to pick her up from the train.
Maureen assured them it was fine, though, and that she had enough money to get home from the train.
And that was the last time anyone heard from Maureen.
Melissa Mary Bartholomew was born on April 14, 1985, in Buffalo, New York. Her mother, Lynn, was only 16 when she became pregnant.
Melissa grew up with Lynn and Lynn's parents, Linda and Elmer's four-bedroom colonial home in the Kensington Bailey neighborhood of Buffalo. Lynn worked at a nursing home while Linda helped raise Melissa. As far as we can tell, her father, Mark, really wasn't in the picture during her childhood.
Now, to paint a picture, the mid-1980s was a tough time in Buffalo. A lot of the big companies that had previously called Buffalo their home had moved, laying off loads of union workers, leaving a gaping hole in the economy and causing a lot of blue-collar families to struggle financially.
On top of all of this, there was quite a bit of racial tension in Buffalo.
Right, not exactly an ideal place to grow up.
Regardless, Melissa's family stayed in Buffalo. Elmer and Lynn juggled busy work schedules, trying to keep the family afloat.
This meant that Melissa was kind of just in charge of herself from a young age, which wasn't really an issue. Melissa was smart, and growing up, she made friends easily.
Not to mention that she was a total spitfire. Her mom described her as being totally feisty. According to Kolker's book, Lynn's one rule for Melissa was that she was not allowed to throw the first punch.
Sounds like my kind of girl.
1000% agreed.
Now, when Melissa was about 9, her mom met a man named Andre, and together they had a baby girl named Amanda. Andre and Lynn didn't wind up working out, and much like Melissa, Amanda grew up at their grandparents' house.
Now, something to note, which I just think is something kind of fun, Andre was black, which means that Amanda was half black. Apparently, Amanda used to be jealous of Melissa for being white, and Melissa used to be jealous of Amanda for being mixed, which, if you ask me, is the most, like, sistery thing I've ever heard.
Now, while Melissa was smart and a social butterfly, things started to go off the rails for her once she started high school.
She started staying out all night during the week, skipping school, and just hanging out with the wrong types of people.
One of those people was her boyfriend, Jordan. According to Kolker's book, Lynn thought that he was bad news and wanted to keep Melissa as far away from him as possible.
So, because she was a woman of action, Lynn sent 16-year-old Melissa to go live with her father, Mark, in Dallas, Texas.
Listen, I know I'm a New York girl and I'm totally biased, but if my mom sent 16-year-old me to Texas, away from all of my friends, I would have thrown myself out a window.
Honestly, my family knows about zero people in Texas, but I'm absolutely positive there were times my mom thought about sending me to Texas or wherever 1,000 miles away when I was a teenager just to give herself a break from me.
I can totally see that.
But back to the point, just as I'm sure we would have, Melissa hated living in Texas. She fought with her dad a lot, and from what we can gather, she really wanted to be back in Buffalo with her mom and Amanda.
To demonstrate how badly she wished to leave Texas, Melissa actually stole her father's work truck and drove it around Dallas without a license. Since Melissa was only 4'11 and 95 pounds soaking wet, the police pulled her over pretty quickly and realized what was going on.
Melissa's dad swiftly sent her back to Buffalo to reunite with her posse and her family.
However, things didn't necessarily get better for Melissa when she got back to Buffalo. While she was living in Texas, her grandparents sold their house in Kensington Bailey and moved to the Alden neighborhood, which is much more rural and essentially farmland.
Because the home was in a new neighborhood, this meant that Melissa would have to go to a new high school and not the old one where all of her friends were still students. This clearly was not going to cut it for Melissa.
Since Melissa was 18, she decided she wanted to move out. She got an apartment near Lynn's sister in South Buffalo, which allowed Melissa to finish high school with the people she started it with.
Melissa was grateful that Lynn let her move out and become her own person. The two became closer than ever, and Lynn was so proud of Melissa when she made the decision to start a career and go to beauty school.
The only thing that Lynn wasn't crazy about was Melissa reuniting with Jordan.
According to Kolker's book, they began seeing each other on and off once Melissa returned from Texas.
But regardless of Jordan dragging her down, Melissa graduated from beauty school and went on to get a job at a few salons, as well as holding down a part-time job at a pizzeria and a diner.
While Melissa was gainfully employed, it was still hard for her to make ends meet. Salons really weren't able to thrive in Buffalo since getting your hair done is a luxury, and Buffalo's economy never really recovered from the hit it took in the 80s.
Melissa often expressed to Lynn that she really wanted to be able to take care of her and her grandparents and be able to provide for herself,
This is why Melissa's family was not entirely shocked in 2006 when she announced that she had gotten a job with a man named Johnny Terry and that she was moving to New York City with Jordan.
What you may be able to piece together at this point, and what Melissa's family didn't know, is that Melissa's new job was not cutting hair.
Johnny Terry was known on the streets by his pimp name Blaze, which if you ask me, is a pretty lame fake name.
With Blaze watching from a safe distance away, Melissa, or Chloe as she was known to her clients, frequented a strip club named Lace and began hanging around Times Square in the late hours of the night, or the early hours of the morning, depending on how you look at it.
From the bottom of my heart, I can absolutely assure you that there is nowhere I would want to be less than Times Square at 3 a.m.
Yeah, I feel that.
While many in the escorting business, including Melissa's close friend Kritzia, didn't think tiny little Melissa could make it to New York, she proved them wrong.
Melissa worked in New York for 3 years until she disappeared in 2009.
While she worked in the bright lights of Times Square, she actually lived in a basement apartment in the Bronx.
She also had like 8 cats, which sounds like a glimpse into my life in 10 years.
Now, Melissa liked city life, so she didn't go to Buffalo super often, but when she went back, she always came with gifts.
One year, she gave Amanda $500 just to get new clothes for school.
I love that.
Me too, but the problem was Lynn and her new boyfriend Jeff were suspicious how Melissa was making so much money.
So Melissa lied and told them that she was dancing for a nightclub, but that they shouldn't worry because no one was allowed to touch her.
Which, of course, was not the case. Melissa was a successful escort. Guys liked her a lot.
Her and her friend Kritzia were like frickin' frack, running the New York City escort life. They even got matching tattoos.
Melissa said Blaze, and Kritzia said her pimp's name Mel.
Can we get matching tattoos?
Sure, yours can say I hate, and mine can say Lisk.
Genius.
While she may have had his name tattooed on her body, Melissa wasn't always a huge fan of Blaze, and her family definitely wasn't either.
He only met her family once, but Amanda got the impression that he was a total loser.
While Melissa's mom was thankful that she was no longer with Jordan, she didn't like Blaze any better.
By 2008, Melissa was basically completely over Blaze, and she began taking her business almost exclusively to Craigslist.
Melissa was doing better than she ever had before, since she was able to keep 100% of her profits. When she went back to Buffalo for Christmas in 2008, she told her family that she was almost done with the city and would be moving back soon.
Then, on July 11th, 2009, Melissa sent a text to Amanda, trying to persuade her to come back and visit her in the city.
The following day, July 12th, 2009, the camera from her local bank recorded Melissa depositing $1,000 into her account.
She was last seen alive that afternoon, sitting on the curb outside of her building in the Bronx. Her phone records show that she made a call to Blaze in the afternoon, but it was under a minute long.
However, Blaze would go on to say in the interviews that he knew for a fact Melissa had a $1,000 date out on Long Island on the night of July 12th, 2009.
And for the record, Melissa's going rate for an overnight was about $1,000, so that checks out.
The next day, Melissa didn't return any texts or phone calls from Lynn or Amanda.
Lynn and her boyfriend Jeff tried to file a missing persons report, but because Melissa was 24 and had no history of mental illness, police completely deflected their attempts.
It took them 10 days for police to even start a missing persons investigation.
And from what we could tell, it would have completely died away if Amanda didn't receive a phone call from Melissa's phone on July 16th, 2009.
And we will definitely get back to that in a later episode because trust us, it's nuts. On January 18th, 1988, Megan Waterman was born to her mother, Lorraine Waterman, in Portland, Maine.
According to Lorraine's mother, Muriel, Lorraine was quite the wild child.
Lorraine had apparently dropped out of high school and moved out of Muriel's low-income housing apartment when she was 19.
Soon after moving out, Lorraine met a man named Greg, who had become her first boyfriend. Greg was controlling and abusive and caused Lorraine to spiral into a drinking problem.
Soon after they moved in together, Lorraine became pregnant, and the two young adults welcomed a son, also named Greg, into the world.
Lorraine and Greg would be on and off for some time before finally splitting up for good when Lorraine was 8 months pregnant with their second child, a girl named Megan.
Lorraine's sister Liz and Kathy had been telling Muriel that little Greg was constantly bruised and dirty and was hardly ever fed, Muriel refused to let her grandchildren be raised in such an unsafe environment.
Muriel, Liz, and Kathy collected evidence against Lorraine. When Megan was only a few months old, Muriel applied for custody of both little Greg and Megan, and she won.
Now, Lorraine didn't believe that Muriel really had her children's best interest in mind. According to Kolker, Lorraine and her husband Doug gained housing through federal welfare subsidy. It was called Aid to Families with Dependent Children.
This basically meant that they had housing as long as they had minor children who were dependent on them. Once their children turned 18, they lost their housing.
And wouldn't you know, right around the time Muriel was filing for custody of little Greg and Megan, her youngest child Eli was about to turn 18.
I smell a conspiracy.
And regardless of the motives of all parties here, this caused major tension between Lorraine and Muriel. Muriel resented Lorraine for turning her back on her children, and Lorraine hated Muriel for taking her children from her.
Lorraine would eventually sign her parental rights over to Muriel, though with the caveat that she was allowed to see the children.
So Greg and Megan were raised by Muriel.
And let's just say Megan's childhood was a bit hectic.
Megan and Greg were only about a year apart, and they fought physically frequently. Muriel was older now, and it was harder for her to keep up with the kids.
There are reports that Megan and Greg would just run around the neighborhood screaming, "Fuck you!" at everyone they saw. And I have to say, I kind of respect it.
That's amazing. And that's the kind of attitude Megan had at home with Muriel, and with Doug too. She thought she had complete control over Muriel and Doug, and she was mostly right.
She was a complete firecracker. She had the police called on her for the first time when she was only in the first grade. Apparently, there was a bridge connecting two buildings about 30 feet over the sidewalk, and Megan climbed over the railing and would not come back down.
When she was in second grade, she was diagnosed with ADHD and transferred to a school for troubled kids. However, in the fifth grade, she was removed from public school after she tried to dunk a kid's head underwater in the school swimming pool. She didn't actually want to hurt the kid, she just thought it would be funny.
There are tons of Megan stories like this in Kolker's book, all of which I love. Megan was full of bravado, but also totally carefree and an adventure seeker. That's why people gravitated towards her.
Now, when Megan was finishing up middle school, or junior high, I'm still not sure what the difference is, Muriel and Doug moved the family to a trailer park on the outskirts of a town called Scarborough, Maine. Scarborough was quite different from the neighborhood their previous government housing was located in.
And Megan notices immediately. She thought all the kids in Scarborough were complete snobs, and they all walked around with their designer shoes and expensive clothes.
Megan began to rebel after moving to Scarborough. She got picked up for shoplifting from Walmart a few times, even being placed in a jail for young offenders on more than one occasion.
When Megan turned 17, she dropped out of high school. She continued living with Muriel, and she worked odd jobs to make money.
Megan partied a bit, like any good young adult would, and after a hookup in a bathroom with a 32-year-old DJ, Megan was pregnant.
In the summer of 2006, Megan welcomed her daughter Liliana into the world. Megan also rekindled her relationship with Lorraine, and while they never became close, having a child softened Megan to her mother.
Liliana, who Megan lovingly called Lily, was clearly the best thing that ever happened to her. Lily did soften up Megan's harsh edges. Megan's infamous temper and volatility had seemingly vanished.
However, becoming a mom created a lot of new stress for Megan. She was struggling to make money, and her main goal in life was to give Lily everything she ever wanted and deserved.
Megan also wanted a stable environment for Lily, something she never really had herself.
While Megan was kind of an angry child, she grew up to be romantic, constantly searching for love and for somebody to accept her with all of her flaws.
Megan's longtime social worker, Joe Moser, believed Megan was searching for love in people because she never had secured love from Lorraine.
Now, things didn't work out between Megan and Lily's father, and she soon found out that she had a thing for guys from New York.
Well, who doesn't?
Forget about it.
So naturally, the reported love of Megan's life was a New York guy named Akeem Cruz, or Vibe, as everyone in Portland, Maine knew him.
So Vibe, and I'd really like to stress that Vibe is spelled with a Y instead of an I, was not only Megan's boyfriend, but also her alleged pimp and often abuser.
Vibe was from Brooklyn, a housing project right near Coney Island, and he was 18 when he got charged for reckless driving, unlawful possession of marijuana, criminal possession of a weapon, and a slew of driving violations.
And like any upstanding citizen, instead of facing these charges, he flew to Portland, Maine.
Oh, sure he did.
And to be honest, and also according to Kolker's book, it's a bit unclear when Megan got into escorting. Megan's half-sister Allie, who Lorraine gave up after losing Megan and Greg, believes that a boyfriend before Vibe got her into the business.
With the money from escorting, Megan was able to move out of Muriel and Doug's home and into her own little apartment.
She told Muriel and Doug that she got a job dancing at a strip club on the outskirts of town.
Lily, on the other hand, stayed mostly with Muriel and Doug.
And with her newfound freedom, Megan moved her vice from vodka to coke and ecstasy.
Her lifestyle had amped up a bit. She began splitting time between staying with Vibe and staying with Muriel and Doug.
Vibe totally encouraged her escorting. He would even post ads for her.
While some of Megan's friends knew about her job, her family certainly didn't. So when her brother Greg eventually found out, he went a little berserk.
In the spring of 2009, she and Vibe made their first trip to Long Island, which I think is kind of weird. Like, if you're looking for big money clientele in New York, wouldn't you hit up like the Upper East Side of Manhattan first?
It does seem kind of random, but Megan and Vibe made quite a few of those trips together, even when their relationship was on the rocks.
They would be kind of on and off, if you want to call it that, for the next year. Vibe wound up being briefly incarcerated, and on top of that, his abusive nature seemed to even worsen.
Right, so Vibe made bail and was released from incarceration on May 31st, 2010. Once he was released, he and Megan decided to make a trip to Long Island to seek clients.
She told those close to her that it would be one of her last trips because she and Vibe were going to settle down and they were going to try to give Lily a sibling.
So fast forward a few days from Vibe's release to June 5th, 2010. Megan hopped on a bus from Maine to New York, which I'm assuming was brutal. How far is Maine from Long Island anyways?
Please hold, I'm gonna pull up a Google map. Okay, Portland, Maine is almost 8 hours away from New York City, and Megan wasn't even going to New York City. She was going to Hop Hog on Long Island.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know Hop Hog, it's pretty far out east, like in the middle of Suffolk County.
Which hits pretty friggin' close to home for me since my boyfriend grew up there. I'm pretty familiar with this area. It's about 90% upper middle class families with decent sized houses and big yards.
Not exactly a place one would stereotypically picture sex workers thriving.
Exactly.
But anyways, on June 5th, 2010, Megan made that long 8-hour bus drive down to Hop Hog alone because Vibe had gone back to Brooklyn a few days earlier to visit family.
Yeah, she checked into a Holiday Inn Express in Hop Hog right off the Long Island Expressway.
Also known as the LIE, also known as Hell on Earth.
Exactly. So around 8 p.m., security cameras at the Holiday Inn captured Vibe and Megan leaving the hotel together.
Yeah, but at 8:30, Megan came back to the hotel alone. She made a few phone calls, one to Lorraine around 10, and one to her brother's girlfriend, Nikki, around 11.
She also called Muriel right around midnight, and she said that Vibe was going out with some friends, but she was tired and she was going to stay in and go to sleep.
However, that was not exactly the case. Right after she hung up with Muriel, Megan, or Lexi, as she went by on Craigslist, posted an ad.
The ad read, "Jump into a world like no other. Please no blocked calls or text messages."
Megan then talked to Vibe on the phone around 1:20 a.m., and then 10 minutes later, the Holiday Inn security camera captured her leaving through the lobby.
And that's the last truly confirmed sighting of Megan.
There were witnesses who said that Megan was seen walking down the service road of the LIE towards a convenience store, and I definitely would not feel safe walking down the LIE or even an LIE service road. It's crazy busy.
Completely agreed, but Kolker speculated in his book that this convenience store would be a good place to meet a client that didn't want to be seen.
So Vibe went to Megan's hotel the next morning and she obviously wasn't there. He began to panic and called Megan's friend Sharina.
After that, he even called Muriel. However, he fed her some fake convoluted story about Megan calling him and saying she was going to get food at 2 a.m. and then when he got back from partying at 6 a.m. he had a concierge check on her and she wasn't there.
Vibe even called the police and told them that she was missing and gave them a description of what she was wearing that night.
As previously stated, Vibe had a criminal record. When Megan went missing, he immediately became the prime suspect in the eyes of her family and friends.
Vibe was even arrested shortly after Megan disappeared. He got caught in a hotel raid with $1,300 worth of crack on him.
Once Vibe went to jail, a lot of people just assumed he killed Megan, and since he was incarcerated, there was no one left to advocate for her. The best day of Kim Overstreet's life was in 1983, the day her little sister Amber was born.
The Overstreet sisters grew up in Gastonia, a few hours away from Wilmington, North Carolina. Like Shannon, Maureen, Melissa, and Megan, her childhood was a bit tumultuous.
Addiction ran rampant in their family.
Right, and when she was only 5 years old, she witnessed her neighbor and possibly abuser die right in front of her. We're not going to get into that story here, but definitely look in Kolker's book for it.
This event kind of led the whole Overstreet family to spiral. Margie, Amber's mom, wound up hospitalized for a nervous breakdown, and her father, Al, began racking up DUIs.
Margie and Al separated, but eventually reconciled when Amber was in middle school. They moved to Wilmington, North Carolina, then to Florida, then back to Wilmington.
The Overstreets settled in a housing project called Nesbitt Courts. When Amber was living there and still in middle school, 20-year-old Kim gave birth to a baby girl named Marissa.
Amber was the aunt everyone wanted to have. She loved Marissa and completely doted on her.
Probably because Amber and Kim were so close. They always looked after each other. Even when Kim would get mad at Amber for wearing each other's clothes.
Sisters, am I right?
When Kim was in college and Amber was still in middle school, Al and Margie suffered back-to-back health crises. This led Kim to essentially become the sole provider and caregiver for the household.
Kim met a woman, Teresa, who introduced her to the escorting service called Co-Ed Confidential. Kim was totally skeptical and not into it at first. She didn't even want to meet Johns. She just wanted to stay in the office and help out.
She made and answered phone calls, and the money started to become a lot more than she was previously making waiting tables.
Eventually, Kim became eager for more money, and it became harder and harder to resist taking it to the next level.
In contrast, around the same time when Amber was a teenager, she began having sex frequently, and it quickly lost its meaning.
She kind of figured out how Kim was able to make so much money, and began to try to freelance her services around the neighborhood.
Amber would eventually join Kim in the Co-Ed Confidential, and while they never told their parents explicitly what they were doing, it is believed that they knew what was going on.
According to Kolker's book, people believe that Amber joined the business in an attempt to not only make money, but to stay close to Kim.
Amber looked up to her older sister, so when Kim began smoking crack and doing other drugs, Amber wasn't far behind.
It was ultimately Teresa at Co-Ed Confidential that opened up the world of drugs to them.
So eventually, and we're not totally sure how, Kim wound up in New York, and she met a man named Dave. Dave fell quickly for Kim, but understood they could never be together due to Kim's complicated relationship with her children's father.
Kim talked to Dave about Amber constantly, who was at Florida in the time, and Dave ultimately realized that Amber had a severe drug problem and that Kim needed to help her.
Kim expressed to Dave that she knew her sister needed help, but she didn't have the money to put her in rehab right now.
Dave didn't care about finances. He flew Amber up to Long Island and placed her in a rehab facility in East Meadow, Long Island.
Kim eventually reunited with her children's father, and Amber eventually got out of rehab and went to go live with Dave.
Dave cared for Amber immensely, and even let her boyfriend from rehab, Bjorn, also known as Bear, come and stay with them.
While Amber obviously cared for Dave as well, she was understandably an addict by nature, and eventually she began using again and she dragged Dave in with her.
With both of them completely dependent on drugs, they heavily relied on Amber escorting on Craigslist to support their addictions.
Kim also really depended on Amber. Kim was still escorting and noticed that when she advertised as a sister duo with Amber, the two made a lot more money.
Dave and Bjorn often acted as Amber's security, but on the evening of September 2nd, 2010, she got an offer that she couldn't refuse. She placed an ad on Craigslist around 4 or 5 in the evening and got a phone call from a man who offered her $1,500 to stay the night with him.
Amber told Dave about the client, and while Dave was suspicious about the high price, he decided it was okay for Amber to go by herself.
At the agreed-upon time, she and Dave left the house they shared together. He walked her across the yard and hugged her goodbye.
Dave may have looked at the car that Amber was picked up in, but even if he did, he was probably too high to remember the vehicle.
Amber was never seen alive again.
Okay, let's take a step back here and look at all of this from a more macro level.
Here's a broad timeline overview. Maureen went missing on July 9th, 2007.
Melissa went missing on July 12th, 2009.
Shannon went missing May 1st, 2010.
Megan went missing June 6, 2010.
And finally, Amber went missing September 2nd, 2010.
For those of you keeping score at home, this means that from the time Shannon went missing until the bodies were discovered, both Megan and Amber went missing in that time frame.
That's right. Megan and Amber went missing after Shannon.
Again, like we stated earlier, during this time, police were not actively looking for bodies or for Shannon because the bramble was too rough and everyone kept getting poison ivy.
The only reason the bodies were found was because an off-duty cop was training his cadaver dog and found them by chance.
So, did Lisk know that no one was looking for anything in that area at the time?
And if that's the case, did he have insider knowledge from the Suffolk County Police Department?
Because again, before the bodies were found in December 2010, there was zero media coverage on any of these missing girls on Long Island.
Right, and from what we're told from police, each of the bodies seemed to have been there since the date the girl went missing.
For example, Maureen's body is believed to have been on the side of Ocean Parkway since she disappeared in 2007.
So, in summary, four working escorts advertising on Craigslist disappeared months apart and were found meticulously buried on the side of Ocean Parkway?
Yeah, exactly.
And these bodies were only found because of a missing persons report that was finally filed for missing escort Shannon Gilbert?
Correct.
Right, so just wondering, where the hell is Shannon Gilbert? If you or anyone you know has any info about the Long Island serial killer, please contact Suffolk County Crime Stoppers. By telephone, dial 1-800-220-TIPS. By text message, text SCPD and your message to CRIMES or 274-637. Or by email, visit www.tipsubmit.com. All tips will remain anonymous. If you have any questions or comments, or if you have any information that you think should be included in the show, please contact us at crimecoastpod@gmail.com. Music is by Matt Sessions and Andy L. This show was mixed and produced by Hannah Green. This podcast is independently created. It's just the two of us doing this. That means we do all the research, write the scripts, conduct the interviews, and mix and produce the show, all while working full-time and going to school. With that being said, we're trying to put out an episode every Monday, but due to the magnitude of this case and the work that goes into creating this show, episodes might occasionally be bi-weekly. As much as we'd love to consistently give you a regular episode every week, we'd prefer to have a well-done episode every few weeks rather than a half-baked episode each week. If you like what you're hearing, please give us 5 stars and subscribe. And please tell your friends and family, significant others, and anyone else about this podcast. It helps our podcast become more discoverable and therefore helps us get the story out. Be sure to check out our Instagram and Twitter at Crime Coast Pod. And please consider joining and donating to our Patreon at Crime Coast Pod. Thank you all for your support, and we'll talk to you very soon.